Welcome to Pivot Matters. I'm your host, Jeff Lynn. Thanks for tuning in. On the show, we talk about the ever-changing landscape of healthcare payments and the impacts to healthcare payers, providers, and consumers. You can follow the conversation on Twitter at hashtag Payment Matters and follow me at Jeff B. Lynn. This is a part one of a two-part series on the role of government in healthcare, including recent regulatory shifts in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. My guest for these episodes is Stanley Nakamson. Stanley is a principal of Nakamson Advisors, a health IT consulting firm dedicated to finding innovative uses for health information technology and encouraging its adoption. The firm serves a number of clients, including the Cooperative Exchange and ENAC. Stanley is focused on assisting healthcare providers, vendors, and plans with understanding the regulatory environment, assisting in the implementation of regulatory requirements, and providing advice on the health IT industry. Stanley is an author of the authoritative paper on the cost of ICD-10 for physician practices and is an active member of HIMSS, WEDI, and X12. In part one of the series, we'll be discussing the history of HIPAA, the evolution of electronic healthcare transactions, and the strides we've made as an industry so far. Stanley, really excited. Thank you for joining me today. Before we get started, You clearly have a long history, as I kind of read through your bio. Mind telling you a little bit of our audience about yourself and how you got involved in the health IT industry?
Oh, sure, Jeff. And again, thank you very much for having me on today. I was fortunate to get involved with the HIPAA legislation right about the time that it was passed in 96. I was working for CMS at the time and was asked by my boss to be part of an agency task force to help implement this new legislation. Frankly, I was a little reticent about it because I didn't know very much about the legislation. I didn't know much about EDI, and I was in the midst of another, what I thought was a more important project. However, he basically told me that that's not exactly the answer that he wanted, and the answer that he wanted and the answer that I had to follow was, yes, work on this new project. So I began my work roughly in 1996 on HIPAA, where we first looked at the requirements and then helped build the regulations, working with the entire industry, with health plans and providers and vendors and others, to craft the first set of HIPAA regulations on electronic transactions and code sets and identifiers and privacy and security. So since then, I have been working to assist the industry on not only meeting those requirements and the ongoing changes that we've seen, but some of the new requirements that the government continues to put out on things like the upgrades to ICD-10, interoperability, payment transparency, and other issues that keep coming up and that impact on electronic data interchange and the provision of healthcare in this country.
Got it. I mean, it's a clearly interesting history, and hopefully there's a book you'll write about this someday, Stanley. But I call it the HIPAA transactions are part of the plumbing that makes healthcare payments work. And so I'd love to understand here, as you kind of embarked on this journey and you looked at the transactions of eligibility, claims, and remittance, what was that journey like? How were you looking at those transactions from a total healthcare payment ecosystem?
Well, there was definitely the thought that if we could take more of the paper-based or fax-based work that went into the entire healthcare claims process, from enrolling beneficiaries to determining their eligibility to for a provider to send in a claim and to get paid, if we could take that out of the paper and put that into the electronic age, there should be a savings. There should be a lot more accuracy. There should be things that are happening much more quickly. There were some early attempts to do that by Medicare and others, but the problem was every health plan had their own sort of way of doing it, their own set of information, their own electronic connections, and it was difficult for providers to get their vendors to work with all of the different health plans. Based on that, the Congress had passed HIPAA and said, let's work with the industry to come up with a standard way of doing it so it makes it easier for everyone, more efficient for everyone. And that's what we did. We took the processes that were mentioned in the legislation of enrollment, eligibility, claims payment, submission of claims, encounter information, and worked with the industry to develop what would be considered industry, overall industry, the best overall industry standards to move forward. And it was a struggle. It was certainly, there was some competition among different types of standards. And as technology changes, we've seen even more changes as we moved from a sort of a batch environment to a instantaneous web-based or internet-based environment that really speeds up transactions and makes a lot more data available to everyone. But there's been a struggle, and we've gotten I think the vast majority of the industry to work on the transactions, and we found some of the weaknesses and managed to upgrade the transactions a couple of times so they continue to work better.
And as you that journey must have been as you said, it was a difficult journey, right, to get there. Was there a secret sauce in terms of getting the various constituents involved and engaged in promoting this common standard for the transactions?
Yeah, and I think there were some issues involved, not only in people understanding what the best transaction would be, what the best standard would be, and some of the arguments among vendors and others about that. But there was, I don't think there was a recognition in the industry that it's not just, oh, we'll create a standard and then everybody will adopt it. There's a lot of education that goes into switching to a brand new process. And the way that this industry, the healthcare industry, works, much of the automation is done through vendors. So even if you, when you come up with a new process, first the vendors have to develop the product in order to implement that. They've got to test that, make sure that it works. Then they have to work with their customers to implement that at customer sites and train their customers to make sure that it works. Then the customers have to get used to doing it. So it's a multi-step process, and it's a long process. It's not something that people can easily adapt to. And what we found is even though the industry continues to change, there is some pushback in upgrading the standards. Once a new standard is put in and people become comfortable with it, there's a lot of pushback to saying, well, don't change it so often. It seems to be working pretty well. We don't want to change it, so keep it the way it is. And we'll deal with it even if there are some weaknesses or changes. That's what I think one of the big learning lessons was, as well as the industry understanding that they all have to work together, that these three pieces of vendors and providers and plans and clearinghouses included in the vendors really have to work together to implement this entire process and get it working correctly.
Got it. So you know, I kind of look at this as that there's a chicken or the egg scenario here, and there's getting the constituents together, or there's a government mandate to do something. Did something occur first before the various constituents got together around this, or was it like there was an uproar from payers and providers saying there's too much paper and faxes going all over the place and it's getting hard for them? What was there, like a triggering event?
Well, I think the legislation was the triggering event.
Yeah.
Not exactly sure what brought on the legislation. There were probably groups of providers or plans or vendors that managed to convince Congress that this was necessary. It also could have been the experience that Medicare and Medicaid had in wanting to move forward. on making their systems more efficient. But it was HIPAA and the legislation and the regulations that really triggered it. And now what we find is that with almost any government mandate or anticipated government mandate, the vendors are somewhat reluctant to make a change until they see a final government requirement. Even if something might be a good idea, there's still a lot of resistance. I'll bring up the idea of electronic claims attachments. There have been a couple of small pilot tests that show electronic claims attachments really help speed along the process in getting a claim resolved and getting the information from a provider to a health plan and in tracking that. And it works very well, but wholesale, the industry has not yet adopted it because they're waiting for the federal government to issue the final rule.
Got it. Yeah. So a lot of this is being driven from the government perspective here to drive this forward here. So,
yes.
You know, it sounds like, you know, I think HIPAA was enacted in 1996.
That's correct.
All right. When yes. That happened. And, you know, we're kind of bordering on almost a quarter of a century. I like to use big numbers here as we look at this. What have been the results to date? You know, clearly there's a lot of work to move all the parties together, but what have you seen as the results in terms of achieving those objectives 25 years ago?
We've gotten what I think is the vast majority of the industry to adapt these standards. There are some laggards, there's a little bit of variation, but the vast majority of providers and plans and vendors understand certainly the claims standard and are using that. Most are using the remittance, electronic remittance advice, electronic funds transfer. And we're seeing a slight uptick and an increasing number of providers and plans using the eligibility and claim status transactions. So I think we've actually achieved most of what the legislation was intended to. There have been some roadblocks along the way. There are still people that are not willing to take on the electronic transactions. There are some health plans that don't want to support eligibility or claim status. But the vast majority of the industry has moved forward, and they've learned some of the lessons that we talked about in terms of working together and the need for a lot of training. I think the ICD-10 implementation was an example of that. This whole process on the administrative side is fairly well regulated and required. On the clinical side, of course, they've taken a different approach where they've set interoperability requirements and asked for EHR vendors to implement them, but they have not really required providers to buy those electronic health records with those capabilities. They've given them some incentives to do that. So it's interesting to see the contrast. I don't think that the EHR and interoperability reach has gone quite as far as the administrative transactions electronic reach. So we'll have to see how those two approaches compare and contrast over the next few years.
Got it. I mean, so the net is like, it sounds like there's good progress there, and there's always more to be done, right? Which is, at least we've made some good progress, especially on the electronic claim side. Where do you see this trending right now? As you know, in certain transactions, we're reaching a very positive steady state here. But are there any risks that we need to be aware of looking forward?
Yeah, you know, there are always risks in the way that healthcare changes, the move to telehealth, and I think there's some issues about the role of patients in all of this and how much information they're going to get. That's one thing. A second risk is if the transactions start to get too stale and there are too many changes and they don't work anymore, how quickly can we update them? The X12 organization is working on completing the next version of the transactions, but I don't see that happening and that implementation happening until sometime in 2024, perhaps. So we've got a long ways to, there's another change. So there's some problem, I think, with the transactions getting old. Two, there's I think, a problem with maybe folks trying to get around the transactions or use them maybe to their advantage in terms of, let's say, electronic funds transfer. There's been some pushback from providers who say that they don't want electronic funds transfer. They prefer seeing that paper check. If health plans go too far and say, no, you're going to do something electronically, whether it's electronic funds transfer or a virtual card, items like that, providers may very well say, forget it. I'm not going to participate with you anymore. And that's going to cause some issues. The cost of these transactions certainly is an issue, and who pays for the continuing upgrades, who pays for the new software. That's another roadblock that we've sort of yet to figure out. And I think the fourth issue that we still need to deal with more completely is on the privacy and security side, security especially, as the healthcare industry is becoming more and more the target for cyber attacks. We need to do a much better job of protecting the electronic information. And if we can't do that, people are going to start saying, well, I don't want to do this electronically anymore. I'm going to go back to a paper-based system.
Yeah, this is clearly a lot of concerns out there. Healthcare, you know, being such a large part of the economy. But the one thing here is as I'm, you know, we're in the midst, when this episode is recorded, we're in the midst of a pandemic right now. And clearly COVID-19 is out there. And I look back and I look at the financial industry, and I recall back then there was a lot of paper checks being sent, and 9/11 created some significant changes because all commercial planes were grounded and they couldn't move the checks around the country. And I kind of really look at, you know, COVID's here, and I hope it's going to go away. I hope there's going to be solutions for it. But, you know, I think this is a bit of a transformative event in our country's history, but also within healthcare and healthcare payments. And would love to kind of get your sense of maybe just part of it's my opinion, but do you think there's going to be a lot of change out there post COVID? And if so, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, my opinion, I think, is a little different than yours, Jeff. This was certainly a horrible event for the country, but I look at this as more of a one-time event, and hopefully that'll be true, that we won't have a large risk of undergoing again. And I think people will try and take a few bits and pieces out of it, but I don't know that there's going to be wholesale changes. I certainly think that folks are recognizing there's value to telehealth, that on both the health plan side, that they're now willing to pay more for it and pay it on a more frequent basis, especially allowing telephone calls. And I think patients are taking some advantage of that. But I've already seen the statistics where as provider offices are opening, again, more and more folks are going back to the in-person side. The percentage of telehealth is dropping. I think there's room for it. I think we should keep it as an option. I think there are a few things that we should keep as options, but I don't see a wholesale change to the industry. I think, you know, there'll be people that are pretty innovative and might do some things to help the payment process, to improve the use of some of our mobile apps, to allow patient payments, for example, or allowing more patient payments over the internet rather than having to deal with them in the doctor's office. but I don't see a wholesale change. Now, a lot of this, I think, will continue to be led by Medicare and Medicaid, as we've seen so far in the pandemic, that as the government has allowed more things to happen in Medicare, a lot of the commercial plans follow. So it'll be interesting to see what the government will do. They've already talked about expanding the use of telehealth. They're allowing the Medicare Advantage plans, for example, starting next year to use more and offer more telehealth options. So we'll see that. On the payment side, you know, especially when we deal with individuals, it's not just giving them the capability, it's giving them the I'll call it the usable capability. You can have all the apps out there that you want, but if somebody doesn't really understand how to use them for whether it's telehealth or payment, they're not going to be widely adopted. I mean, Zoom, a lot of people have come up and tried to use Zoom. There are some of the folks that have been unable to use it, and they're not going to continue using it or look to go to telehealth. They're going to go back to the old ways. So usability and availability, but I see changes more around the edges than a significant upheaval to the industry.
Got it. And it's interesting, you know, you read a lot of articles where everyone's promoting major change across the industry. So it's always good to have a balanced look at this. And clearly you've been in this industry for some time here. In terms of the role of the federal government, outside of the telehealth items that were recently addressed, do you see anything else changing in terms of new regulations in light of COVID-19 or things from an administrative transactions perspective?
Well, I think COVID-19 has put a slight pause into some of the other work that's going on. But I really see us going back to this focus on interoperability and the electronic exchange of information among providers, between providers and health plans on the clinical side, and the beginning of the use of these applications for individuals to get their own healthcare data. So there'll be some continued work by the government, Office of the National Coordinator and CMS, to push those kinds of efforts. I also see more devices in the home enabling monitoring, more use of, you know, blood pressure, intelligent blood pressure monitors or heart monitors or diabetes monitors, things like that, to help individuals keep track of their vitals and send them automatically to providers. Also to have warnings when something happens so that you can immediately pay attention to it. You know, back a number of years ago, I thought of the sort of the ideal app, especially when some of the voice technology was in there. And I could see getting up in the morning and turning on your phone. And in my case, it would say, oh, good morning, Mr. Nockamson. It's nice to see you. By the way, your weight last night was a little bit high. You know, don't eat a donut this morning for breakfast. Your blood pressure seems to be on a nice and steady course, but you also haven't gone for your run in 3 days. Why don't you try and do some exercise that gets your heart rate up? Your dental exam is due next month. I see you've got it scheduled on your calendar. Remember to do that. And by the way, check, give your mom a call because, you know, she's whatever, she's 85 and you need to check on her. It would be fascinating to have an overall health assistant app that could work with all of these devices and just give us reminders. Much as they've talked about some of the, you know, the EHR alerts and even in some of the revenue cycle programs, if you know, a doctor's accounts receivable gets too high, or if somebody is behind on a bill, you sort of get an alert in your system. It would be interesting to try and get some of these alerts personally, so you can better manage your own health. That's what a lot of this person-centered health care system is built on, people managing their own health. And certainly giving people the tools to do that would be nice. I'm not requiring that they do that, but making those kinds of tools available. And, you know, the role of the government might be to help some of the standards for that and to encourage commercial health plans and providers to get involved in those kinds of efforts.
Those are the payment matters we're tackling today. Thank you to my guest, Stanley Nachimson. Be sure to tune in next month for part two of this series on the role of government in healthcare. And thank you to all of you for listening in. Remember that you can listen to this episode weekdays at 4:30 a.m., 12:30 p.m., and 8:30 p.m. Eastern. You can also listen on Apple Podcasts and Google Play Music, or just say, Alexa, play Healthcare Now Radio. If you have a comment about the episode of the show, follow hashtag Payment Matters or connect with me on Twitter at Jeff B. Lynn.